Yeah, and everyone pronounces it Tolkien, but it's Tolkien, so that sucks to be y'all.
That's a good point. And welcome to Vassals of King's Graves, a great linear A Song of Ice and Fire reread. This is episode 95, which is huge. This episode could potentially spoil any events in George R. R. Martin's published series, including TWOW preview chapters, but I'll try to flag those up. And it will not, however, contain show spoilers, especially since I'm on the call. The last episode ended with Cersei's Walk of Shame, and in this episode we will cover Theon 5, aka the Turncloak, Dany 7, and Arya 2, aka the Ugly Little Girl. It's all from Dance. The events take place between June 20th and 24th of the year 300. Kind of incredible that we're still in 300, but anyway. Meanwhile, the events of Jon Con 2 and the King's Prize / Asha continue to take place over this period. So I'm Mary, and I'll be your host today, also known as Nymary on the forums. And with me tonight we have Matt Varley.
Hey, Varley on the forums.
Great. We have Bina.
Hey, everybody. Bina 007 here.
Matt 2.0.
Hey, Blue Armor on the forum.
We also have Adam.
Hey, this is Adam, Drowned Snow on the forums.
Great.
Titles.
Okay, and that's it for today. So, after Cersei 2, we jump back 24 chapters to Theon 5, and this takes place on the very next day, June 20th. And I think Varley is doing a recap for us.
Sure, so we get a good look at Winterfell and what's going on while Stannis waits in the snow. In the hall, Theon is weighing his options about, you know, whether he should escape or not. You know, he goes through his normal kind of bipolar talking about escaping, but then realizing he's not as brave as he was because he's Reek, and Reek isn't a person that does such heroic things, and so he kind of has all this self-doubt for good reason. We take a look outside where the kids are playing with snowballs and everything's kind of like a lighter atmosphere. The horses are shivering in their stables. Theon walks into the Godswood and has this really kind of moving moment where he thinks he can pray to these gods, but then doubts himself, and he hears Jane Poole sobbing. So kind of a roundabout look at Winterfell and what's going on there. In the hall, Rowan, one of the washerwomen of Aebel, seems very interested in how Theon was able to conquer Winterfell and if maybe there was any secret tunnels, entrances, or exits. But Theon tells her basically to piss off. Lady Dustin then grabs him and asks to be shown the crypts of Winterfell, and once they're down there, she tells him lots of information about Brandon and how charming he was and how he wanted his sword so sharp it could cut a cunt hair. What a charmer. How she loved him and how she wanted to marry him, but Rickard Stark had Sauron ambitions, and I think that's the first time we've heard that. And then Lady Dustin has some rather awful plans for Ned's bones, because she blames him for the loss of Brandon and her tie to the Stark, and then later her husband. And that's where it ends. I really didn't have anything new and amazing to say about this. I did look up Bear, which trimmed Lady Dustin's dress, and that's a bluish-gray squirrel. And that's about it.
So, Lady Dustin is like supposed to be really old, is the impression she gives, but she can't be that old, right?
She's got to be like 40, maybe.
Because she talks about how she's like old, and she like, I don't know. I guess the way she talks about herself, like, it makes me envision that she's like wrinkled and gray, but but Brandon wasn't that much older than Ned, and if he took her maidenhead, she couldn't have been that much older than him, right?
Yeah, and I think Ned was, like, 32 or 33.
I think, she's in the same generation. She's just, well, maybe a bit of a mistake on George's part here, but also the way she sees herself as this bitter old woman whose husband died quite early in her life.
Yeah, I think it's more just like the widow thing, and at least in this world, you know, past her prime childbearing years. I think it's more just like, you know, no one's looking to take her as a to get a second husband.
And it also, it's not about how we see her. It's about, in that society, people seem to live these very telescoped lives where you're sort of old quite early. And it's internalized misogyny. You know, society sees her as past value, and so she sees herself as past value, even if she's probably only 43, which is basically my age. I am also old and withered and bitter and past value, too.
Oh, Bina, you've been married for what? 2 months?
I know. We leave the opposite of telescope lives these days. We don't even, like, get going with life.
Right. Yeah, if you're 25 in this world and you're not married, you've
wasted away.
You might have a chance left, but not much.
Yeah.
So I think it was brought up in the earlier Theon chapter, but again, we're just reminded that, like, maybe not everyone at Winterfell is on board with the Boltons. But I think, again, that's just repeated news. This chapter, I don't know. I'm having that weird memory problem where it's like, I thought this chapter was a lot cooler than it actually is, and I just found it to be, like, Lady Dustin's very petty and, you know, in a revenge scheme, and not as interesting as I think I remember it.
I mean, I think there's plenty of interesting tidbits. It's just that, you know, we've spent a lot of time going over them in the past. So, you know, kind of rereading it, there's nothing really new we can, you know, glean from all of the discussions we may have had previously.
Oh man, you guys are so down on this chapter. I love this. I love these chapters general. I think they're amazing.
I like this chapter. I'm trying to be more positive about it, because there's a lot of stuff with, you know, the missing swords, and as well as just Lady Dustin's kind of motivations in general, as that's, you know, a hotly debated topic. I just think it's a little hard to tell where she's at this point, just because she kind of has, you know, she has hatreds towards, you know, three relevant houses when it comes to the Starks, the Boltons and the Freys, and it's going to come down to, like, you know, which one she hates the most as to kind of where her loyalties lie. But it's somewhat hard to predict at this point.
I think you guys are all very negative on this chapter. This chapter is the first one in my 2-volume paperback edition of Dance. And by the way, we have now finished with the first volume of that. So I got very choked up reading this, because I actually figured out that, oh my goodness, we're done with all but the final paperback volume that I have. That made me very sad and sort of melancholy. And maybe that kind of influenced my reading of these three chapters. But I was pleasantly surprised at how thoroughly I enjoyed them. I thought this was such a good chapter for Theon. He's so aware and politically astute, and if only he trusted himself and didn't slip back into Reek. He's a bit like Sansa. He's gone through all this trauma, and he's becoming a really interesting observer. And I felt that as an open, I don't think it's any particular reason behind it, but as an opening chapter for the second volume, to sort of set the scene of what is happening in the north and all these different factions moving into position. We don't quite know what Lady Barbary Dustin's doing, but we see some of the history of the northern houses. It was a really beautiful overview. So I really thoroughly enjoyed it, I have to say.
Well, I mean, I feel like it's just wheel spinning while we're waiting for Stannis to get to Winterfell, which he never does in this book. So it's just, I guess it's more frustrating in that aspect where it's, you know, we get it that Ramsay's bad and whatever he did to Reek was awful, But, like, these half hints and half remembrances of Theon of what happened, it's, I don't know, I'm getting bored of it.
Oh my goodness, I just thought it was beautifully written. I mean, there's this line where he's talking about, there's
there are ghosts in Winter.
No, when he says there were no chains, at least none that men could see. Like, he's really aware of how how Ramsay sort of, how psychological abuse and coercive control works. And I think that's very impressive. And I don't know. I mean, don't you get excited reading about the missing crypt swords, or are you guys over that too?
Well, we know what happened to him. Hodor grabbed him.
Like, I mean, I think that it's like there's important stuff that's laid down here, but also as the Reek turning into Theon chapters go on, we get more and more of, like, Ramsay is really good at one-on-one, like, manipulating and intimidating and controlling people. Like he said, you know, there are no chains that you can see, etc. But then Lady Dustin here says that, you know, hey, if he wants to keep the North, like, he best have Lady Arya smiling once in a while. Like, her cries are, like, more dangerous than Stannis' swords. Like, he's completely inept at, like, you know, controlling the masses or working with allies. And, you know, Roose, who seems to be better at that, is also just sort of letting him go along with that. So, I don't know. You would think that he would, you know, get his pleasure somewhere else, and he would treat fake Arya a little better, because he kind of needs her, at least until the other lords have left.
Yeah. Well, the reason he goes after her is because she is fake Arya, right? Like, he knows that she's a fake, and that he doesn't have to pretend he can be as brutal as he wants to.
Well, right, but he does need, like, this whole, for everyone else there, even though a lot of them don't necessarily, they aren't necessarily sold on her being Arya, like, he needs this to work, he needs the show to work.
Yeah.
Just like he needs Theon to, you know, front as Theon. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I just misremembered this chapter. I thought there was a lot more in it, and it's the same thing that happened when I did the Griffin Reborn chapter. Like, maybe I've, like, there's just been too much time in between my rereads where I've been like, oh yeah, that chapter, like, is the one where, like, all this stuff happens, and then I reread it, it's like, oh, actually, not much actually happened.
Well, I think a lot of that is like the that Jon Con chapter, this chapter, like, we get bits of, like, Brandon Stark backstory. We get bits of, you know, Rhaegar backstory that has been spun up with stuff from other chapters to make theories, to have this whole life in the fandom. So, I mean, that it may not exist right here on the page, but all of that does kind of stem from these chapters. It's born from that. So that's why maybe it feels like that there was more in these when you read them, because, you know, you go to Reddit or you go to our forums and, like, you know, we're going off on this stuff. But, I mean, all of that, the seeds of it are here.
Yeah.
I kind of feel this dissatisfaction with the chapter speaks more to the time that we've had to mull over it than the actual quality of the writing and the chapter itself. It speaks to a kind of boredom with the, well, we know that we're not going to get, we could have a whole discussion about why does Lady Dustin want to be in the crypt? Is it psychological closure with Ned? Is she trying to find out some information tactically? But, yeah. What are we going to do with that? Because we know by the end of the book it hasn't come into play yet.
Yeah, I think you're right, Bina. Like, I keep on looking for, like, more Easter eggs and not finding them and being like, well, then I know this chapter already. I know everything that there is to know about it. So, yeah, I think maybe that's it. That it's just been picked to death and we're still looking for little new pieces and there are none.
I still find it very evocative. Like, I opened up the book on a very sunny day as it happened, and I was immediately in Winterfell. I had this very vivid visual depiction of what it was, how the crypts were. I just felt it was a beautifully written chapter, and I think all of these three chapters are well written, and again, just gives me renewed faith in George that even late era dance, he was writing good stuff.
But yeah. There's an interesting line that Theon thinks where he's looking over the burnt Wintertown, and he says, wounds that snow make, capital S snow, snow conceals, lowercase snow. So, like, you know, he's talking about the bastards, but I was wondering maybe if that could pertain to John too. But then I'm just grasping at straws.
I mean, I will say, yeah, Ramsay's kind of burning and sack of Winterfell is kind of coming back to bite them as they have to, you know, try and rebuild some of this stuff, especially the stables and whatnot. Yeah, no, I do like this chapter a lot. As I mean, I think, you know, especially in terms of writing, I think Theon's chapters kind of remain the best POV in Dance. And there's some pretty good scenes here going back and forth, and you know, in his head between Reek and Theon, and the conversations he has with Rowan and Lady Dustin, always suspecting, still trying to think things out. We get kind of his acknowledgement that, you know, he really wants to be one of the Starks, and we kind of get that that loyalty, like switching from Pike to the Starks, kind of at this point where he can't really go back to the Iron Islands anymore, and you know, he's trying to pray the Godswood as well in front of the Weirwood tree. Something in your recap, Barley, I don't have the book in front of me, but it seemed there was an interesting thing talking about, like, you know, hearing someone crying and hearing the tears.
Right.
I think that passage is meant to say that it's not Jaime he hears, it's himself who's kind of like crying and falling forward, like in front of the Weirwood tree.
Yeah, I could see that too, but I think it is you hear Jaime sobbing, but I thought it was interesting, like when I first read this, because I thought it was him sobbing, but him blaming either Jaime, or even says, like, do the gods cry? Like, maybe, like, he's trying to put it off on anyone else but him. So
yeah,
I see what you're saying.
That was my interpretation.
Yeah, I didn't read it like that, but that was a question I had, actually, because Lady Dustin also mentions Jaime's crying, and, like, I assume people hear her crying when they go near her room, but they don't hear her everywhere in the castle, obviously, because she's weeping, she's not making a lot of noise, I would assume. So it's kind of weird, this ever presence of her crying everywhere, like everyone can hear it all the time.
Well, I think it adds to the ambiance of Winterfell that it is in a sad state compared to its former glory, and it's held by people that are not the Starks.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
There's
I feel
a lot of roofs that are, you know, destroyed and open air areas and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
This chapter, like the previous Theon chapter, actually, but it makes me really nostalgic, and like Bina, like you were saying, we feel in Winterfell immediately, but we also see what we've lost and the town that it was, the castle it was, it's lost now, and that chapter makes me feel that very deeply, which goes on to say that George writes this really well.
And even the idea of these kind of like jerry-built new gates, and, you know, Theon's wandering around and thinking, gosh, these aren't as beautiful as the old ones. They've just like hacked them in, and there's no beauty to them. It's all practical, but it's been done, right? I mean, there is an efficiency, a brutal industrial efficiency to the Bolton rule. I mean, arguably more effectively in some way than Ned, but
which almost makes it more sad, you know, because
they are effective in a way.
Yeah, but they're not beautiful.
Well, I mean, we're told that like Roose Bolton put the squatters of Winterfell to work and said he'd be merciful, and mercy was at the end of the noose. So I mean, they had a slave labor force there that they just, you know. They needed new doors, so they threw up new doors. They needed a new stable, they threw that up. And then I wanted to, like, in my recap, and I don't think it came over as well, but, like, I just imagine, like, seeing it from, like, you know, 50 feet above Winterfell and just kind of looking from the Great Hall into, like, the yard, into the stables, onto the wall, into the Godswood, and then back into Winterfell and then down in the crypts. And I feel like it would, in, like, TV or a movie, it would be, like, one single shot where you could see, like, everything that's happening. And I think what would be interesting is the dynamic of who is outside and who is inside, because it seems like all the snowmen are everyone who has joined the Bolton and Fraze, except for the Bolton and Fraze, and they're all in the main hall being warm and, you know, eating beef stew or whatever. They make a very fat snowman.
It's kind of hard to make a really slim snowman, isn't it?
I think it'd be really hard to make a one arm or missing half his arm.
Okay. Any other point of discussion on this chapter?
I guess my only real points of question, but maybe this has been answered before, is what do you think Lady Barbary Dustin wants with the crypts? Do you think it's just that conveniently for us, she just wants a bit of a psychological walk down memory lane and therefore we get all the backstory, and if so, that's fairly clumsy? Or is it, does she need to see the crypts for some reason?
Like, is she just verifying the bones aren't there, you mean? Or
why? I mean, it just seems to me like if she's not there for a reason, that then becomes revealed. She's very
interesting character. You mean like part of a plot, part of some scheme? I don't know if that's true. Maybe if she suspects anything, like the missing swords.
Maybe it's...
I don't know.
But it's not a flippant request. She's like she's had her people search for the crypts and she cannot find them. And so Theon. So there's, maybe it's like, you know, just a point of catharsis for her to say goodbye to Brandon.
That's what it comes across as. But there could be more to it.
I think it makes sense that it's more psychological than actually, intrigue. Right. I assume she's been to Winterfell in her life, but now she's there and she doesn't control the place, but she's there.
The crypts, right?
Yeah, exactly. And here she has the power to get in.
Like, he's insistent to get down there, but like, he barely knew Lyanna. And it's like a sort of thing, like, I feel like only the Stark family really goes down there. Like, I don't think that the vassals or anything go down there and pay respects, right?
So. Yeah, that's my point, is now she has the power to find it and get in, and it seems like she's asserting her power on the Stark family. Like, you're all dead and I'm still alive, and I even go into your crypt, and that's powerful.
I don't know why it can't be one that doesn't lead to the other, right? It could just be that, like, this is her emotional catharsis and she wants to see Brandon's grave and all that, and then getting down there and noticing the swords missing and things, maybe that activates some sort of plot where she realizes they're not dead, or, you know, I don't know. But not necessarily what her intention going down.
Yeah, I don't think it's like some kind of like National Treasure Dan Brown book where there's like some kind of secret code hidden in the crypts for her to discover or something. It's just...
No, but what Wilson is writing in a chat actually makes sense. I mean, it could be that he's saying that maybe it's part of the Northern conspiracy because they need a hiding place for where whatever the plan is goes down. That could be your answer, Bina, or like a possible answer.
I would hope so, because otherwise it's just she needed to walk down memory lane to tell Theon some backstory for us. Which feels a little bit weak. She's like so set up. She's like Chekhov's widow. She's so set up to be mysterious and conspiratorial. I feel it needs to have a big payoff.
Yeah, she probably, in terms of story wise, she probably does open up a little more to Theon merely for narrative convenience than anything else.
Well, I think she knows that, you know, the last two lines of the. The last few lines of the chapter are like, you do well that you never speak of what we talked about down here. And Theon's like, oh, I got it. Hold my tongue or lose it. And she's like, you've been trained well. Like, I don't think she would be able to do that to actual Theon, like pre-Reek Theon, because he wasn't, you know, broken to the point of, you know, where she had that sort of control over him.
Does George love Theon?
I think he does, yeah.
I mean, like, every Theon chapter
that's a hard
is really well written. What he does with Theon is maybe his most impressive character journey, the way he takes him from kind of, like, the rogue to the hated betrayer to, you know, this. You have no idea who this guy is, then he's tortured, you feel sorry for him, you realize it's Theon, etc.
He's like Smeagol, right? I mean, he's got to be fun to write because he's so psychologically complicated.
Yeah, I think he's way easier to write than, and that the plot around him is way easier to write than obviously Danny is, because he can see where this is going and he can see where Theon is going, and he can take it at whichever pace he wants.
He has so many tools he can use in Theon chapters, and there's no one else to see the things Theon is seeing.
Mm-hmm.
The going back to the crypts thing, I mean, the only other, I think, tinfoil thing is if there's just deeper down the crypts, there's some escape hatch or something, but there's no real evidence of that other than just mere speculation.
Well, indeed. Oh, well. We will wait. And maybe we'll find out.
Yeah. Anything else?
Run off of mere speculation?
Yeah.
It's what we've been doing.
It's what we have, Ollie. It's all we have.
Oh, come on. It's too early in the call to get all melancholy.
Yeah, guys.
Okay. Anything else?
Let's see. There were ravens spying on Theon. Something to note, I suppose.
Yeah, but then he went to the Godswood. That's like direct telephone.
Right, yeah, direct line with the werewood as well. I don't know. I mean, we don't need to run over Southron ambitions again, although I definitely just heard, as I'm reading it here, the dun-dun-dun, the wink at the camera, Southron ambitions. and that's about it. I haven't done real research into the swords and other stuff. I plan on doing that for the ghost in Winterfell chapter coming down the line.
We do have him calling himself a ghost in Winterfell already.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's been, I think it's happened over the past couple chapters.
Yeah.
I think it's highly likely that Lady Dustin knows that Arya is fake.
Oh, that's, yeah. I mean, she suspects it very strongly, I think.
Yeah. The problem is, when we see all these characters for the first time, I think it's for, the Harvest Festival, and Arya and Sansa are already gone. So I don't know when the last time they would have, seen Arya.
As I was kind of looking over stuff, looking at the wiki for Lady Dustin, it seems that for the trip from Barrowton to Winterfell, she's the one, she insisted on taking charge of Jaime, so... We're kind of assuming that she found out during that trip, basically confirmed.
Yeah, I think for anyone, Lady Dustin is quite observant, I think, and from Jaime's behavior and even Theon's behavior, she can probably, even if she doesn't have the actual confirmation, she can suspect it.
But she's an anti-Stark, or at least she fronts that to Theon, although...
Yeah, it's... We don't
know. What else would she say to Theon, because Theon is so closely connected to the Boltons?
Well, that's still a mystery to me.
Right. If he reports to his master that, Lady Dustin is pro-Stark, that's a problem for her, right?
Yeah. So she doesn't have to be this, bitter nasty, but she certainly couldn't be, rebellious.
God damn it, Lady Dustin.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. We don't know who she hates the most. That's what it's going to come down to, is to who she hates the most.
What's your plan? What are you aiming at?
Anyway, so we skip forward just one chapter to Danny 7, which takes place a day later on June 21st and 22nd, and thank you, Bina, for jumping in for this chapter.
It is my pleasure, because this was a Danny chapter that was actually also, I thought, cool, which I don't normally say about Danny chapters. So, as the chapter opens, Danny's getting her rocks off with Dario. He asks her to marry him, but she shows remarkable self-awareness. She realizes he doesn't actually love her, that sleeping with a powerful queen, and that if she marries him and doesn't marry his star, she'll lose her kingdom. So she will become immediately less attractive to him. So she's under no illusions that
He's basically a dumb jock who's semi-useful, but also great fun in bed. That said, she's having nightmares that his star is a warlock with an ice stick. Interesting. I think that whole nightmare says more about George than it does about Danny. Dario then introduces her in a very long-winded way to hashtag Quentin is alive. Garrus Drinkwater and Archibald Ironwood. We get the backstory on how Willem, Darion, Oberyn, Martell planned a very secret alliance many years ago, which would be sealed with Viserys marrying Arianne and Dany marrying Quentin, and so the former lot ruling Westeros and Dany and Quentin ruling Dorne. Her own very special super weedy frog prince of her own. She doesn't seem hugely impressed by Quentin as a suitor. But nonetheless, even though he's very weedy, this causes Dario to try and flex and mock Quentin and just generally be a dick, which we are very familiar with by now. Dany also decides that she's not going to trust the Dornish because she remembers Quaithe's prophecy, warning of the sun's son, which is very clearly alluding to Quentin. So she goes ahead and marries his star. We also get a lot of backstory on Dany's mum, Rhaella, being courted by a member of the Kingsguard back in the day. And we also get, probably more interestingly, the story of King Aerys being in love with, well, not in love with, but lusting after Joanna Lannister and quote-unquote taking liberties during the bedding, which I assumed was some kind of sexual abuse, but not rape, because there is a point where he's complaining that there isn't the right of the first night, so it's something short of that, but still pretty horrible. And I think sets up the relationship that many years later, at a certain tourney, he probably did rape Joanna and potentially produce Tyrion, but I guess we can get into that. And all the while this is going on, the Yunkai are prepping a siege to starve Meereen out, and George notices, or she notices, that they're not actually building proper siege engines in order to storm Meereen. They're just going to wait for disease and starvation to do its work, which is pretty grim, because we've all heard the tales from Stannis about what that is like. So it's horrible, and I think it serves, having that mentioned at the start of the chapter, just serves to show that she's in a real bind and she has to marry, you know, either person on offer, Hisdar, Dario, or Quentin. That these are not great options. So I kind of had some sympathy for Dany, and I really like the chapter because there's a lot, I think, like with the Theon one, there's a lot going on in terms of just setting up the stage of what's happening in this part of the world. So I really enjoyed it.
Today Quentin dies, huh?
I don't see a fucking chain of evidence. Chain of custody. We don't need to get into that here in this particular episode.
We'll have a specific episode just for that chapter, because but it will come up.
Titled Quentin Lives.
Obviously. I mean, Bina is probably already written down to host it, so we'll have that discussion. For now, let's not talk about Quentin's impending death, or at least bad burning.
He has like awful timing, huh?
Yeah.
Gets there like day before the wedding.
Well, he got there earlier, but Danny wouldn't hold court, so.
Yeah, he definitely takes that first meeting with Danny, I feel like, way harder than he should. Like, I feel like, I don't think she was as mean to him as he perceives. It's just that his timing was god awful.
Yeah.
Yep.
But since everyone else was mean to him, I get why he's feeling this way after that meeting.
You understand based on the character he is why, you know, he would perceive that as just such a staunch rejection. It's just one of those things where his personal history kind of skews his perception of that.
Well, even in one of the Barristan chapters later, like, his two buddies, like, one of them goes, yeah, he threw himself at your bitch queen and she just laughed in his face or something. And I was like,
right, yeah, but that's ridiculous. Like, I think that was pretty hilarious calling him frog. I would have laughed too. Yeah.
I have
this has a lot of uncomfortable sexual writing. Can I just say that? That's sours me on the chapter.
Yeah.
She took him in every hole that was possible for women or whatever.
She prepared him with her mouth as he taught her, and then Quentin is revealed, and I'm like, I'm still not over fucking Dario.
Her shouting out, "You're beautiful," for some reason.
Yeah.
She's like what? 16,
I think.
16? So I can forgive her for being seduced by the weird troll man. She's a child.
With a blue forked beard.
Golden tooth and all.
Yeah, he dyed his hair blue again just for her.
Well, that's love right there.
Yeah, and then this Quentin kid shows up and she's like, yeah, no, thank you.
And she's like, well, the other knight was actually kind of sexier. Couldn't you be him?
But I think it's established. I mean, I don't think we need to relitigate the fact that George is a terrible writer of sex and a great writer of horror.
Yeah.
And food.
Right.
Yeah.
So in my darkest moment, I wrote to myself, these two chapters are so early in A Dance with Dragons second half, and yet neither of the battles they presage, Winterfell and Meereen, has happened by the end of it.
No, the whole fucking book is setting up for something that doesn't happen.
Right, but which anyway. Is the great disappointment of dance.
Yes.
Anyway, more constructively, I thought it was interesting having this chapter, if we talk about the linear reread, it was interesting having this paired with the Theon chapter, because I think both of them are incredibly self-aware about their position and the motives of other people, which shows real growth. So, when she has that very, almost chillingly, clear sort of paragraph about why Dario is with her and not being under any illusions about that, I thought that was it showed a maturing.
Well, I agree, but at the same time, I also think that her advisors don't really respect her. They don't really fear her at all. She's kind of lost the dragons, and everyone can see that. And she used the "I'm only a little girl and know nothing of," insert the right word, she's used it too much, and it worked to her advantage at some point, but now it kind of seems to me like she's too much into character and people actually start to consider her like that.
Yeah, you can't play that trick too many times. People stop buying it.
Well, or they will believe it so much that there's no respect for her anymore. And even she doesn't really express as herself in this chapter. Not a lot. She's very resigned, very... she doesn't really hold court anymore. She's giving it up to fate and hoping that Histar will bring peace. And I get why she does that, because she's so stuck in this situation. She has really no other choice, but she's not as she's not like she was before the Blood of the Dragon, a Targaryen. She's more submissive.
But isn't that realistic? I mean, if you've lived through watching your revolution, your Velvet Revolutions getting overturned, and then living in a city which is basically under terrorist siege, I think this is actually realistic. She can't just constantly be this Mary Sue who goes from victory to victory and gets out
absolutely.
Of jail.
Absolutely.
I think it's really good writing, this idea that she's still clever, she's still self-aware, but she is also very, very stuck in a hard place. And these jokers are turning up from Dawn. She's got this guy who, at one point, she's like, oh my God, he's going to go off and slit some people's throats because he's that much of a jock dick. And, no one is sensible around her to help her out.
So you're right, it's very realistic, but it's also, I think it shows how much George himself is stuck on her story, and it's the story leading George and not the other way around, but not in a good way, not in the way that it's easy to write, but in the way that he got stuck and it gets worse and worse.
Well, we know that the Meereenese knot or whatever really held up this book, and it is Danny's storyline, I think, that he's dealing with, because I think that there's been such a label put on him of turning tropes up on their head, that he doesn't want this, you know, rightful heir to the kingdom to come back and get the kingdom so easily. And I think it just gets him tripped up. He buys his own hype, so he doesn't want to do what's expected of Danny, you know?
I will say the kind of the final line of this chapter is, I found particularly good and does relate to Theon's a lot, where her and his star, you know, walk out, like, chained together. They have, like, their marriage customs. They have them, like, chained, you know, with, like, hands and feet or something. I forget exactly what it was. But I really enjoyed that one where it's, you know, we've seen what happens when you chain a dragon in the crypts, it can't grow, and now we get that kind of physical manifestation with Dany herself, and that this marriage is chaining her to a person that she can't, where she can't be an effective ruler and a conqueror of Westeros.
Yeah, it's a deeply, deeply tragic chapter in some ways,
mm-hmm.
and very similar to Theon, because they're both these people who don't really know where they belong. And there's this awful line where she says, you know, it will never be my city, it will never be my home, just as she literally marries one of the native aristos and chains herself to ruling it. And, you know, to me it's very similar to Theon. He's just stuck out of time, out of place, very aware of the predicament he's in. And it's horrid. Really,
yeah,
horrid.
Except that in the Theon chapters, at least when you think of the Great Northern Conspiracy, you kind of have some hints that something is preparing. And yes, we don't see it yet, but I wouldn't go so far as to say there's hope in Theon chapters, but there's something exciting, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely spot on with everything you said about George writing this, and that he's evidently enjoying himself when he writes the Theon chapter. And there is something very meta and analogous about Danny's situation and George's situation when he's writing those chapters. It's like he's describing himself chained to that desk. He's got three options. None of them are good for plot. And it's Danny is George, right?
Yeah. It's still a good chapter, I agree. I really enjoyed reading it as well.
Yeah, for sure. I loved it.
Yeah. I had one point, actually. I think it was interesting how Dany kind of rewrites history in the light of the love she later developed for Drogo. Because she mentions their wedding night, and she's like, I was terrified, but also so excited. And no, she was mostly terrified. And I don't want to get into the whole discussion about their wedding night, really, but it's interesting to her character, I think, to see how she thinks back to that day and that part of her life.
Yeah, it's very similar to Sansa and mm-hmm. and misremembering the kiss with the Hound.
But I think it is instructive, however, that when you go back and read that Game of Thrones chapter and her wedding night, it isn't that kind of unpleasant experience that it was depicted as being in the show, where he basically just sort of bends her over and she's in tears and he just takes her. I mean, it's not
right.
Like that.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's not love at first sight and he was my son and stars immediately. Like, it took some time.
No, you're
and
right. Agree.
Okay. Anything else?
I kind of feel like if you're Doran and you're sending in, you know, your son to go and woo this woman, or maybe you should send him a bit like Prince Ali of Ali Ababwa, like in Aladdin. Like, you want to go in looking impressive. Like, you can't be smuggled in with two mates. You've got to go in on a big fleet of ships.
Right.
And like,
was his worry that they would get caught? Or something, like they their plan would be seen and brought back to Westeros.
Well, I think he couldn't just send Quentin with a big fleet and just show to the world that Quentin was going to get to Dany. But I think he expected something a bit in between with a bigger retinue and not going by hiding themselves. But once they were in the right part of the world, assuming...
I guess because he's always trying to keep his options open, how bad would it have been if he had been like, hey, I think she needs a fleet to come home, and he just sent a fleet? I mean, that he would have been saying, well, you know, prepare the passes for war, I guess, but the crown is already kind of busy. I think he would have had time.
I mean,
but isn't that against Doran's interest of, like, working the subtle subterfuge?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. He doesn't want to do that. But I'm saying, how badly would that have turned out if he had, what I'm saying?
Yeah, the other question is, how much of a fleet does Doran actually have?
That's a good question, because I don't think he has a big one, because ever since Nymeria and everything, they don't have boats anymore, right?
Yeah, but that's doesn't right, he have, like, ties over in Norvos or something? Can he hook
you mean
up
the
something?
Golden Company? And like, I mean, all those, you know, like, there's the ships the Golden Company has. The Volantis fleet is already going to attack, you know, quote-unquote
with
attack
the
Marine itself. I mean, well, the Golden Company, like, bought some ships from Volantis, but then with the new elections, a lot of the Volantis fleet is actually sailing to war to Marine itself. I don't know that there were, I don't know exactly how many ships he had and if there were a lot of options. And
yeah.
There's so many other kind of fleets out there at the moment that I don't know how much it would have worked.
And when did Quentin leave Dawn?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know timeline.
Yeah, I mean, I'm asking because a lot happened in King's Landing, and obviously right now it's hell, and it's nothing works, and the crown is quite busy with everything else, and maybe they wouldn't really care, but I don't think that it was as true when he left and when Doran made the plan.
Right, right. Because things actually take time in this world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you, because I imagine it would be somewhere around the time that Tywin died. Like, if it's something you could have done if planned enough after Tywin died, probably.
Yeah, but not before.
Yeah.
I have nothing else.
And I think you also cannot change the fact that Quentin is not a Prince Ali kind of guy. And even right. Even with a bigger, like, with a fleet and
Quentin
something.
Even Aladdin, okay?
but, you know, like, I was just going to say, like, Prince Ali was not really a Prince Ali kind of guy. And that was my point that, you know, Doran should recognize that his son is no great shakes. And therefore, give him retinue, give him people that will... Give him a fleet, give him something.
Okay,
that is not going to just want the physical presence of your son,
well,
right?
But Aladdin had a wizard, okay?
Like 50,000 spears or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he
promises Dawn.
Like,
yeah, that's a good gift.
What,
right, yeah.
But
he has nothing with him
most...
in the day of this wedding that she needs right now.
Yeah, what she needs most right now in terms of Westeros, at least, is a fleet. And so I think perhaps it's something they could and should have waited on until she got closer to Westeros.
Agree.
I mean, it probably wouldn't
work
out anyway, but, like, you know...
It was crazy to send him into this huge, huge trip that couldn't work.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if, like, because his retinue is, like, in half, right? Like, half the people he left with died along the way?
Right, from 6 to 3, like, that's not...
Yeah, but one of them's a maester, another, you know, like, maybe that would have, like, carried a little more
weight.
Yeah,
50% seems more devastating than that.
Yeah.
poorly handled.
Yeah, for sure. I think, though, that Dany, she is a little quick to judge and decide to not trust him because of Quaithe. Prophecy, because I don't think the prophecy actually warned her about everyone in the prophecy. It was more of a, well, they're coming, but it's not necessarily they're coming and it's going to be bad.
Doesn't she just say beware the XYZ?
Yeah.
Mina, did you call her Quaithe?
Yeah. What's her name?
Well, Quaithe. I think everyone pronounces it Quaithe.
Yeah, and everyone pronounces it Tolkien, but it's Tolkien, so that sucks to be Yule.
That's a good point.
Venus speaks the Queens.
Me and Queen Liz, we know the name of Quaithy. When I'm round at Buckingham Palace for tea.
Yeah, it's like all those plebes that call it a gif. Am I right, guys?
Back in the day when you were 20, if some dickhead frog had turned up with like no retinue, would you have taken him as your husband? She'd be like, no, I would have married Prince Philip. He was like a tall military officer. He had peeps. You know, kind of conversations we have.
Yeah. Just bouncing ideas about Game of Thrones off of
the... I bet you she watches Game of Thrones. She's like 90. What else is she doing? I'm like plotting the downfall of Meghan, obviously.
She's like...
That dragon queen, she's my favorite.
Okay, this took a turn. Are we done with the Danny chapter?
I think that is the signal that we're done with the chapter.
Okay.
My only other...
God damn it, we're done with the chapter, man!
this is a quick dismissal. Like, it's just, you know, that weird little dream she has. I just want to mention it. You know, the weird little dream, whether it's a warlock, you know, having a corpse spouse, blue lips reference to like Euron or warlocks or something. It's just, you know, it's something to file away for, you know, future foreshadowing. But, you know, it was like two lines, so there's really nothing to pull from it.
Well, thanks for bringing it up then.
Thanks, Matt.
We can move on.
No, I agree. It's probably of significance just to her character, even if it's not to the plot. So moving on. So we jump forward 20 chapters again to Arya 2/ The Ugly Little Girl, which takes place 2 days later, on June 24th. I don't know how the guy even knows that it's 2 days later, because it's so disconnected. But anyway.
We don't even know if it's a guy, actually. I mean, it could be a girl.
That's right.
Yeah, why can't it be a girl, Marie?
I mean, this is Reddit, so it probably isn't, but, you know.
It can be a girl. I'd be very happy with either, frankly. I don't really care. So, Matt, the other Matt, can you do the recap for us?
Sure. This is going to be long. Just bear with me. And now an excerpt from The Game of Thrones for Dummies, Chapter 9, How to Become a Master Assassin in 10, 15, let's say 23 easy steps. Number 1. Witness your father's execution at the hands of a child who is also engaged to your sister. 1A. Before you see your father's severed head casually roll across the steps of a place of worship while a crowd of your fellow humans vigorously cheer his capital punishment, like that reaction shot from the Aquaman trailer, get him to hire a personal bodyguard of the leader of another kingdom who is somehow retired and has free time now? Yeah, get that guy to begin training you in rare combat arts that fit your small stature, because nothing beats the advantage of being born into a rich and powerful family. 2. After your extremely niche trainer gets killed, while protecting you, and after this sniveling, snot-nosed kid, who has also already caused the loss of your pet and the death of your sister's pet, randomly decides to go off-book because he got bored torturing cats and maybe his own brother or something. Anyway, after that kid starts a revolution in one sentence, escape the city with some posthumous help from your father, of course, and conveniently run into a member of the most exclusive Assassin's Guild in the world, save his life, and convince him to kill people for you, because it's all about who you know. 3. Somehow trick this master assassin who is much more intelligent and knowledgeable than you. Was it a test the whole time? Nah, you're just that good. Get your foot/coin in the door. 4. Be outdoorsy, or at least naturally athletic. Well, having your own stables, barracks, and blacksmith as a kid certainly helps. Again, that wealthy family. Oh, and you definitely need to be able to kill people in cold blood. Your first should probably be by age 12 or so. 5. Street smarts. Gotta get that solid practical real-world experience, you know, get a job in the service industry, participate in a battle, witness torture, be able to keep your cool around a mean boss, learn the terms of the industry, find out resurrection and magic are possible, squire for an outlaw knight, get stuck in a loop of kidnapping and escapes. Street smarts! 6. return from your study abroad only to find that your mother and brother and most of your fellow countrymen have been betrayed and murdered because a 90-year-old man still can't handle rejection. 7. Have no one left. Father executed, mother murdered, oldest brother murdered, sister imprisoned and forced to marry the enemy, pet wolf went AWOL, younger brothers murdered and burned, allegedly, trainer and protector number 1, dead, probably, protector number 2 who helped you escape, dead, definitely, protector number 3 who almost got you back home even though you vowed to kill him, is currently dying at your feet and begging you to give him mercy. 7A, super important side note here, do not kill protector number 3, your sister will need him later. Number 8, pay your entrance fee. 9, alright, onto the 5-year gap, cue the music, begin the training montage. Wait, what's that? What do you mean, too many flashbacks? Alright, then when you begin your training, do something to make you stand out, like a guy, like killing a guy without permission so you can skip some levels. 11 is the new 20, you know. Jesus Christ, she's still 11 in the Mercy chapter. Can we officially retcon everyone's ages here? No? Moving on then. 10. Anyway, continue with the accelerated training. Should you ever be forced to train while blinded, just use your rare magical gift that you inherited from who? That's right, your family bloodline, in order to use a cat's vision to see for you. 10A. The waif is not your competition. The waif is not your enemy. The waif is there to help you with your training. Do not get into a Terminator chase scene with the waif broadcasting to the entire city that you're members of the Assassin's Guild. 11. After you've cleared enough Ingrams from your body, learn the true secrets of the many-faced god, visit the Hall of Faces, and undergo exteriorization by absorbing your first face. Reach FM level 1. 12. Successfully complete your first assignment. 13. Start an internship to continue training. 14 through 23 are unknown at this time. Higher levels and practices are closely guarded by the church. But what's life without a little mystery, a little adventure, a leap of faith into the abyss, a wager for one's very soul? If you aren't willing to risk, end up getting frozen in the heart of a storm, have you truly lived? Remember your house words, just do it. That's it.
Bravo. That's
well done.
We should probably do any mercy chat in the after show, though. People who are not.
Yeah, no, I wasn't gonna.
Man alive, it only takes 12 steps to get sober. So what was this chapter about?
Well, she's becoming an acolyte.
Yeah, basically she gets her first assignment and kills the insurance guy, whatever you wanna call him. And then there is a really good scene with all of the various other members of the Faceless Men. No, I know, but you know, it's fair. It's fair to actually summarize it after in a meaningful way.
It's about how she isn't really leaving Arya behind, but she's pretending.
Right, yeah, she's still
no
fighting with that. This is one of my favorite chapters. Arya being my favorite character, and there's a lot of good Faceless Men info and for me, always, you know, the key line when first reading this chapter is, you know, how the Faceless Men pick out their targets with, you know, I know this guy or I do not know this man. And so that just kind of, you know, it threw away one theory of her getting assigned to kill someone that she is aware of, where the Faceless Men purposely don't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, also, conflict of interest.
Yeah.
But is it like they wouldn't go through with it, or they'd be recognized, or?
Well, yeah, or they would do it for the wrong reasons, and it's not the Faceless Men way.
Yeah, you're supposed to do this without judgment on the other person.
Like it changes anything.
I thought it was extreme judgment that the Faceless God had determined that he had to die.
Right, yeah, but it's not. But
it's not their judgment.
Carrying it out, like, but they're not. It's not their place. It's not. It's their place to carry out the mission, not judge the person, as that's already been done for them.
Which is like very hypocritical, because in the end, they do decide to kill the guy. So.
Oh well, yeah. I mean, that's a given. You know, there's plenty of. You know, there's plenty of holes in this mythology of theirs.
Yeah.
But it is interesting with Arya getting her first assignment, where, you know, she goes through this whole process of trying to basically, you know, pick out flaws in this guy's character to make him out to be an evil person and kind of, you know, justify her reason for killing this man. And, you know, and the kindly man is always like, you know, no, this, it's not your place to do this. He's just a normal guy. But, you know, he's been paid for and the price has been made and therefore.
It might be something that actually drives her away from the faceless man is that she's not, I don't think she's going to take that bullshit that we don't judge, we only carry out the deed.
Yeah. Hmm.
So the scene where she gets her new face was vividly written and like amazing when she feels the fear and the feeling of the girl she's wearing the face of, and she feels like someone is strangling her, someone is hitting her. I thought that was really powerful writing.
Yeah, I think it goes to what Bina mentioned before, like how good George is at horror writing, and like that you do feel kind of suffocated, like you kind of, you know, you feel claustrophobic reading it. You know?
But it's psychological horror as well. Like, yeah, obviously it's creepy to have all these faces and all of that, but it's he grasps the terror at being beaten, and that's quite interesting.
Yeah, and I just love like kind of getting a solid explanation as we can get to like kind of how their particular brand of magic works with obviously the blood being important as it drips down her face and then, you know, physically kind of absorbing this face like into herself, and you know it's my interpretation that essentially that face is now a part of her, whereas, and she can, you know, kind of switch between that and her own, or any other one she kind of takes on at will when she gets, you know, good enough at it. And also kind of like how they're able to.
Okay. So once you've melded with it, then you can switch back and forth whenever you want.
Yeah. That's always been very cool. Yeah. That's my theory on it.
Yeah. That's interesting. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Does that mean that the faceless man cannot use this face anymore? They cannot give it to anyone else.
Yes, I would say so. Well, I mean, it's unclear as to whether or not they can then take it off of her again.
Right. Well, but why would they want to reuse it? Because like,
I don't know.
Some little girl going to be looked for as a murderer.
Yeah, but well, not necessarily a murderer, but at least a thief. But there could
be. Once she's in Westeros, she can use it, right? I mean, it.
Yeah. Exactly. And there could be others. I don't know. Other faces that could be very useful to multiple faceless men, and it just means they can use it on only one person.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not for us to know what actual blood magic it can do. I mean, we've seen what it can do in these books, but I don't think we're meant to know like the extent or exactly how it works, just that it's like the most powerful magic that you can do, you know, which I think, you know, goes all the way back to the first book with like Mary Mesder or something saying that.
Yeah, I agree. It's nice for it to be a bit enigmatic. I think this is an amazing chapter. I think it's befitting of a character like Arya to get such a strong final chapter. And I can't believe it's her final chapter that we're reading.
That's crazy, isn't it?
The only note really I had, other than just being thrilled at the quality of the writing, was that, again, it's another character who feels homeless. There's a point where she says, literally, if I leave, where will I go? And that's what Theon thinks in his chapter. If I leave here, where will I go? I can't go back to my home islands. They don't want me there. I can't go anywhere else. Everyone scorns me. This is pretty much where I'm stuck. Danny has a kind of similar thought process where she's like, you know, I'm kind of stuck here. I have to, as Marie says, become not Targ, submissive. This is where I'm stuck. And I think there's something really very melancholy about all three characters who are very unmoored from their home and their families and their traditions.
But I think in Theon's case, he actually admits that Winterfell has been more of a home to him than, you know, Pike or the Islands ever had. And that his place should be here. And, you know, there's a line, there are ghosts in Winterfell and I'm one of them. So I think that might be the difference.
He becomes more maybe reconciled to it, but still being a ghost is a melancholy thing.
Right, right, because it implies you're dead. You're not the person you were.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought there was... Sometimes it's forced, but I think here there really is a thematic similarity between the three chapters. I really do.
Yeah, I agree. But in Arya's case, I think it's interesting to... I mean, to me, it shows hope. It gives me hope for her character. And it's weird, because at the same time, she's going deeper into the Faceless Men organization. But in this chapter, when she's like, but where would I go if I left? It's sad, but it also shows that the reason she does that is more because she doesn't know where to go except here, and not because she really wants it. I don't know how you can really want it anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know how that makes you feel hopeful for her.
It makes me feel hopeful because I believe that when she has a reason to get out of the Faceless Men, she will use it. And it will help her to find herself again.
But I think the more indoctrinated she becomes, she'll learn that it's not just something you could give a 2 weeks notice on, you know?
Like, yeah, for
I
sure.
Think that it will have to be a major thing, like, of, you know, her burning down the entire place or something like that. Like, that she just can't leave.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I agree. I'm not saying it's going to be easy plot-wise, but, I mean, it just shows that there's still a part of her that feels like Arya, and even if she denies it, she's still her somewhere.
Yeah. I think the biggest part of that is her recognizing, finally, her warging ability, and knowing that it's not just dreams that connect her and Nymeria, like she's not just dreaming about wolf packs, that she's able to warg through the cat.
Yeah, that's significant.
I think that might reignite some kind of like Stark thing.
Starkiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, like running into Nymeria kind of later on in the books is something that I think it has a good chance of happening.
Oh no, she's got to like ride Nymeria into battle to defeat the Boltons or the army of the undead or something. That's gonna be awesome.
Defeat an other like on a dead, you know, ice spider versus her on a dire wolf.
I love it. Right, call George.
Yeah, I'm sure he will be happy to hear what you want to see for Arya.
Yeah, I feel like. All right, motherfuckers, I'm going to do the opposite.
Yeah. Something to say about her character arc to the end of this book, because I'm sure for many of us, we read this, and then there was a gap before Mercy.
Yeah.
And I felt very happy at the end of this book. I felt it had come to a proper, you know, she has become now a true acolyte. We've had finally got the big reveal for her, which is the secret of how they change faces, and I actually felt genuinely quite satisfied on my original read, and we can get into Mercy later, but
yeah, she has.
It was a good close for me in a book that didn't have many closes, had lots of false hope. I felt this was a good place to pause.
Yeah,
yeah, I think her and maybe Jamie have the best like final chapters in this book, where it's like, okay, like they're continuing on with their journey rather than. We've reached their almost like turning point and we haven't seen it yet. I don't know. Maybe I said that wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I see what you're saying, Varley. It's just like, I don't think his and Brienne and the Lady Stoneheart stuff is going to get wrapped up in one chapter. So, it kind of needed to be cut there.
But you could see where it's going, and it's in line with their story arc and everything else, where everything else was building up to this one climatic point. Like, there's no battle that Arya is about to go into. There's no battle that Jaime's about to go into. Like, you know, they're going to meet separate challenges, but none of them are going to be... Like, I feel like it's going to be more of Brienne's, you know, pivot point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
than it is actually Jamie's, because Jamie can just die, and then that'd be a bummer. But like, his story arc is complete by him going to Brienne instead of to Cersei, right?
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Gosh.
You just broke Bina's heart. And I agree, like, Arya has very few chapters in Dance, but they're all very significant, and this one was a very good one to end her story arc on in this book.
Yeah, there's no filler in her chapter.
No. Okay.
I don't have much to say about Mercy.
No, neither did I actually, because I don't think I've read it again since.
And also, I think there's going to be a reread chapter, presumably, with Mercy in it. I can't remember now, but.
Well, I think if we want to do that. We kind of.
I mean, isn't it up to you, Bina?
Yeah, we almost decided to include them in.
I'm just flipping forward. I mean, I think it must be there somewhere. I don't know timeline wise how the person put it in. Maybe it's at the very end or something. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I think there'll be a place to discuss Mercy that isn't today necessarily.
Okay.
Because I haven't reread it either.
Yeah. So it might not be the most interesting conversation if no one has read it recently. It'll be interesting to discuss anyway, I think, because we haven't picked on the TWOW chapters as much as we have on the actual published chapters, I think. So if we want to continue this, it's interesting to put them in the timeline. If we just can't wait for the reread to be over, well, maybe not, but I don't think that's the case.
We're in the final 10 episodes.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's happening, and that's including TWOW, so.
I feel very nostalgic.
I know. The end is... I can't believe we've got to this many episodes. Like 95.
Didn't you think Wins would be out by now? When we started?
I just remember 4 years ago when we started it. Well, we did Lord of the Rings in 8, so maybe it'll be like 12. I don't know what I thought, but I didn't think it would be 96.
Well, as soon as we finish, Wins will be announced. We know that's true, so...
Oh, well, let's get on with it then.
It will happen.
No, we need to keep padding it out to give him more time.
Yeah. George is like, no, there's this stupid podcast called VOK. They're doing a linear reread. I gotta wait.
See, everyone out there thinks it's the pressure of Game of Thrones that held his writing up, but really it was the pressure of the reread.
It's clearly us.
It's happening.
Okay. Should we officially end this?
I think so.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for being here today. It was very fun. I don't actually know. Bina, are you hosting the next one? Oh, yeah, because you already put out the CTA. Yeah.
I had to, because I'm traveling out in November, so I thought I need to get that 1 weekend locked down. Although, it's not like a great many people up for those chapters.
If you need me,
I'm in as well. I just didn't write it in because I was hosting this one, but if you need people, I'm always in.
I think these final 10, we might be needing all hands on deck.
Okay.
Yeah. I think they're good. I mean, I was like Skype bombing the VOC kind of reread curator check. Because I just assumed that the chapters are going to be dreadful, and I was reading them going, oh my god, this is really good. This is really good. And, you know, that's kind of sad, but yeah.
Yeah. So for all listeners, the chapters on the next episode are going to be the epilogue of Dance, Victarion 1, aka the Iron Suitor, and Jon 9. So we're almost done with King's Landing, actually. That's what it means.
We are done with King's Landing.
Yeah. Once Kevin is gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, and I have stuff to say about Cersei.
All right. Well, that's one episode to look forward to. Do we have other episodes forthcoming things?
I think that FT Ward is going to do something on Watchmen, but not per episode, which I think is fortuitous, because having watched the first episode of it,
it's clearly set up that it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a slow build. So after one episode, you'd be going like, yeah, I don't know really what's happening. So maybe after three episodes, do one, and then maybe after six, and then the end of the season, depending on how it shakes out.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely could do one after probably this week's episode. There's probably enough to discuss. But
the first episode is like gonna be, would be 5 minutes of what just happened.
What did we just watch? Sure. let me tell you about the Tulsa race riots.
Yeah.
I mean, if but, I
it was really good.
Yeah, I mean, all I would say is if people are watching it and interested, there is a podcast by The Hollywood Reporter called TV's Top 5, where their TV critics, they put out a podcast every week and interview a showrunner, and this week's is with Damon Lindelof, and it does not spoil the rest of Watchmen, so you can listen to it. But it's really interesting with him talking about his relationship to the Watchmen, to Alan Moore, why he's taken the approach to that material. Also, why he picked that particular race riot, it's because he read an article on it by Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's just really interesting on how he approached it, why he has famously said it's a one-season thing, how HBO treats that. So if you want to know all that kind of good stuff, then I found it really... And it's probably like 20 minutes. It was really interesting.
But he's just playing it for one season?
Yeah.
Huh.
Oh, boy.
I would say that I haven't put up a CTA yet, but I have binge watched BoJack first half final season this afternoon. I want to talk about it, so I'll try and make that happen. And cool. I'm sure people want to talk about the new season of The Crown as well, which is out later this month.
Yes, and maybe Catherine the Great.
Any last words, anyone?
Remember me when I was pretty.
I don't remember. Thank you for hosting, Murray.
Well, thank you guys for being here. It was nice. Should do this more often.
Fun chatting with you all. Thank you so
much. Bye, guys.
Yeah, good talking to you guys.
Yeah.
Bye.
Talk to you soon.
See you.
Cheers. I'm actually reading Fire and Blood for the first time, and I plan on asking Patrick over and over and over again to come back and do the series he was planning on doing on that, because we talked about it actually when we saw each other this summer. So
he should. I mean, world book stuff he's done has been amazing. So.
Yeah.
I think, you know, he's a great person for doing some of that lore.
Keeps on having kids, and let me tell you, though.
Welcome, Matt. Welcome.
Yeah.